From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson.
Please, on top of the hill, see there's a similar building there. That is Fort St. Jago.
Father and son, James and Amson Hagen, are on a tour of Elmina Castle. It's one of the many fortresses designed by Europeans, built by Africans that dot the coast of Ghana in West Africa.
Yes, 1665, 66. Some of your soldiers were there.
Before being packed onto ships to make the long, often deadly journey across the Atlantic, captive Africans were imprisoned for months in these white stone buildings. They were kept in dungeons on the lower floors, with living quarters for European enslavers above. The Europeans called them castles.
Any other question, please?
You have something to say?
James's son, Amson, is chuckling because they visited this and other slave castles before. And his dad always asks a lot of questions. James is Ghanaian-American, a retired high school social studies teacher from Maryland. Amson's a graduate student in anthropology at the University of North Carolina.
Okay, were the slaves who were left here, were they in chains?
In most cases, in dungeons, they were not in chains. But really, the difficult ones were in chains.
If let's say 600 people here, who are slaves, they are not in chains. And the masters are maybe about five or four of them. Don't you think that they'll be able to subdue them and free themselves?
Of course.
The guide explains that prisoners were chained when they were taken out of their cells. They were led through a door that he points out. It has a plaque above it that says, Door of No Return. And it's intentionally narrow, so captive Africans had to walk out one by one, from near darkness to sudden blinding sunlight.
Oh, please, can you go inside?
The guide directs the group into the cramped cell. People stand uncomfortably close to each other. Suddenly, the room goes dark. The only light comes from around the edges of the door. The guide has unexpectedly shut it. The nervous laughter lasts less than a minute before the guide opens the door.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, no.
I am a prisoner.
Amson looks relieved.
So that one felt new. But also, since I'm older, having to crouch down. You know, when I was small, I didn't have to crouch.
He examines the door of no return and shudders.
Think about all the work and mental labor that I went into constructing this place so that it was efficient for its task. It's pretty, you know, remarkably awful.
This remarkably awful history is being re-examined this year as people on both sides of the Atlantic try to come to terms with this shameful anniversary. Historians believe the first enslaved Africans arrived in the British colonies in late August 1619, 400 years ago this month. And though those men and women were not the first African people brought to North America, their arrival marked the beginning of American slavery, an institution that has marked and guided the destiny of our country up until today. And equally, it's had an influence on the African continent, which is why we're starting today's show in Ghana. We're teaming up with public radio show The World. They sent reporter Rupa Shenoy to Ghana, where the country has declared 2019 as the year of return for African descendants across the world. It's a part of a major tourism push. But as people from around the globe converge, worldviews are also colliding as they try and reconcile a brutal shared history. Rupa begins our story with one woman who's been coming to terms with that history most of her life.
Mona Boyd owns a tourism business in Ghana's capital, Accra.
Hi, I'm Mona Boyd.
Her company specializes in travelers from the U.S., regular citizens as well as diplomats and elected officials. As one of the organizers of Ghana's Year of Return, she helped arrange a recent visit by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
I'm happy to see people like Nancy. It's sort of like a, I wouldn't call it mitigation, but it's just an acknowledgement, yes, this did happen. And you're not crazy for thinking that this awful thing happened. It did happen.
People had seemed to deny the slave trade happened her whole life. They never talked about it or how it happened. The focus had always been on moving on. Maybe because it had to be. Mona grew up in segregated Arkansas under Jim Crow. She remembers her parents whispering about lynchings in the kitchen early in the mornings, thinking she couldn't hear. In sixth grade, though, she learned that there was another place where people who looked like her lived in pride, not fear. Some visitors from Tanzania came to her nearly all-black school.
This was like, wow, meeting the queen to us.
Mona's been drawn to Africa ever since that day.
Most African-Americans, you know, you know something is missing and you want to be united with it. If you have any level of awareness about your own identity, where you came from, you would have to start asking those questions.
It's a tough history to confront, and some Ghanaians have avoided it, too.
Because we don't look around, we don't look back.
I went to see a local historian who's also a former mayor of Accra.
My name is Nat Amatefio.
People around here affectionately call him Uncle Nat.
Okay, so what are we here to talk about?
I asked him to go back to the beginning, to when the transatlantic slave trade began. Uncle Nat explains that leaders in this region had a lot of gold, and word got back to the Europeans. They named it the Gold Coast. In the 1400s, the Portuguese showed up here with guns.
Primitive guns, but guns. With guns, you had vastly a superior form of intimidation. It made a hell of a difference.
There was already a domestic slave trade when they arrived, Uncle Nat says, although slavery didn't mean what it came to mean in America. Enslaved people had some rights and opportunities. Still,
the system already existed. The Europeans saw it and thought, ah, we can try these people in our lands in the New World.
But Europeans weren't going out and capturing people themselves. They couldn't. They got sick and died from illnesses like malaria. So some African ethnic groups went into business, warring with other groups and selling their captured prisoners as slaves to the Europeans. Uncle Nat says they were organized and intentional about it.
Because somebody has to go out there, somebody has to locate the victims, somebody has to lead an army there, somebody has to capture them.
The Portuguese, the Dutch, and then the British all participated in the slave trade in Ghana. Then, starting in the late 1700s, a shift began to pierce this global industry. The British abolitionist movement, the French Revolution, and rebellions by enslaved people like the Haitian Revolution all spread ideas about equality and humanity.
When the slave trade was abolished, it was a result of a long negotiations with slave owners in Europe, as well as with slave owners here.
Both the British and the new United States of America passed laws abolishing the slave trade in 1807, though outlawing the institution of slavery itself would take decades more. After abolition, the British went from being at the center of the slave trade in Ghana to patrolling the coast to make sure no illegal slave ships got by. They made treaties with African chiefs to protect them from other ethnic groups in a series of wars. Uncle Nat says the British used those agreements to eventually declare themselves the colonial rulers in 1874.
They hoisted a flag and claimed that they were now sovereign.
During the 80 years of British rule, Uncle Nat says the African role in the slave trade was deliberately forgotten.
There is a willful amnesia about the roles that we played in the slave trade, a willful amnesia. Our chiefs and peoples decided, all right, we will not talk about it. Don't ask, don't tell. They created a mythology that we were innocent bystanders whose land was raped by Europeans.
In 1957, Ghana became the first African country to break away from colonial powers and declare independence. It was the height of the U.S. civil rights movement, and African Americans started to travel to Ghana. Uncle Nat was in his first year at university. He and some friends were asked to serve as guides.
So I remember when they asked us, so who was sold? We said, oh, only the bad people, thieves and drunkards.
They were just making it up because they didn't actually know what had happened.
The history had never really been taught. And what history was taught was very sanitized. It was a disaster. A lot of African Americans were very disappointed to find this kind of blasé attitude.
This is about the time Mona Boyd first came to Africa. She had just graduated as part of one of the first classes of African Americans out of Boston College after the Civil Rights Movement.
Most Africans, when I came to this country, would not admit that this even happened.
She says it was disappointing, but there was, and still is, ignorance on both sides.
Some African Americans, because they have a different mindset about, you know, Africans. They think there is a much deeper brotherhood than what I think. But we all have a right to handle this in our own way.
Still, she says, visiting the slave castles changed her.
We were constantly, my generation, trying to prove to white people that we were good enough, we were smart enough, that we deserved to be there. That was a huge big burden. We had to prove that to every white person we went, every job we had. But after I had gone through those castles, I didn't care what you thought. You just couldn't define me anymore.
After Mona went back to Boston, she met her Ghanaian husband, Eric, at a party. She went into real estate. Eric was in IT. Soon they were both making six figures, living in a brownstone in Boston's historic South End, where they could walk to the symphony.
We were trying to get pregnant when the Rodney King thing happened.
Three police officers facing felony criminal charges were among a group of 15 who stopped a 25-year-old black man last Saturday night, then beat him, kicked him, and clubbed him.
It was 1991. She remembers watching that video of Los Angeles police beating King after a traffic stop.
I remember just weeping, weeping, weeping. And I said to my husband, I'm not going to get pregnant if you don't agree to move back to Africa to raise our son. Why should we raise our son here when our son can go to your country where he will not be marginalized in any way? He can be king.
Eric agreed. Their son Selassie was born later that year. Ghana was emerging from a period of unrest, so Mona and Eric waited until the country had a successful democratic election. Then they moved when Selassie was 18 months old.
It was a gift to him because we gave up a lot.
They arrived in Ghana without a clear idea of what they were going to do and ended up starting a car rental business. Mona found working in Ghana liberating.
I was able to let go that conscious thought about race. Is it race? Is it my color? Are they going to do it? You know, I was able to leave that. And it was like having a psychic burden taken off of your shoulders and you could just move.
Mona didn't realize she had more of that psychic burden to shed until a few years later. In 1994, then Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings apologized for the African role in slavery.
And it just made me feel so much better. I stopped feeling resentful, you know, towards Africans about slavery, because I knew that Africans had collaborated big time. To the extent that when they ended it, they went to Europe and said, you can't stop this. Where are we going to get our money? And I was just always, you know, it was always in the back of my mind. And it always created a trust issue for me. And a little bit resentment was always there.
Other leaders and chiefs slowly followed Rawlings and gave their own apologies, like Chief Kwafu Okutu of the Okwamu people.
We've rendered our apology to our kinsmen who were taken from the coast of, especially West Africa, to the diaspora to go and serve as slaves. You know, we jointly condemn that inhumane treatment that was meted out to them. We cannot explain too much why it happened, but all we say is, with all due apology, they should come home and put a closure to it so that we can live as brothers and sisters again.
The chief is a big supporter of Ghana's declared year of return. He's offered land to any African Americans who want to come live here.
You see, home is home. No matter what happened, we think this is where they belong. They are part of us.
What are they moving back home to? That's the question.
Blogger and writer Jamila Wombani Abdullahi is one of the few people who have spoken critically about Ghana's call for people of the diaspora to return. She says Ghana remains devastated by colonialism.
I know the struggle of living abroad, studying abroad. I have done that multiple times. But it is not the same as trying to figure things out in an environment where the system does not work.
Unemployment is high. Poverty and hunger are widespread. If you have to go to a public hospital, you have to bring your own bed sheets, drinking water, and hot water flask. Jamila says some Ghanaians argue that they've suffered just as much as African Americans.
Because I think sometimes that's what it becomes. It becomes this narrative of, yeah, the people, the Africans or the black people in America are struggling more than the black people on the continent or whatever. At the end of the day, the reality is it was an injustice to an entire group of people.
Jamila just thinks that instead of asking African Americans to return, Ghanaians should be focusing more on the people who are already here.
Because I've had conversations over a number of years, and more especially last year, with people who I really considered to be part of those who would help rebuild Ghana. Like, honestly, some of our brightest, most well-equipped people, and they're leaving.
Mona Boyd wants to help reverse that trend. Now contemplating retirement, she's decided she wants to make a lasting change by passing her business on to a Ghanaian colleague she trained. Together, they've made her company one of the most successful in Ghana, in part by offering tours aimed at helping African Americans reconcile with history and heal.
It's a very emotional thing that we do because for the first time, Africans are sent to African descendants of the slaves. We're sorry, forgive us.
They take tourists to a village that used to be a notorious slave market. There, Mona has arranged for the chiefs to hold what she calls culturally authentic atonement ceremonies. Village elders wash the visitors' feet. They eat together. Black Americans get African names. There's drumming and dancing. This year, over 100 people are going through the process. It teaches them, Mona says.
You know, what happened to black people? You know, really what happened and what black people lost? You know, they took the brightest, the best, the strongest from this continent, you know. So what would have happened had those people not left this continent? What would this continent be like?
Maybe in a way they'll find out now if more African descendants around the world follow Mona's path. Her son, Selassie, has chosen to stay in Ghana and pursue a career in music producing, even though she wanted him to stay in the U.S. after college.
I thought he would have a better opportunity, and he said to me, nope, I am not going back there. I do not want to live in a country where they put 30% of the men that look like me in jail.
The reason Mona came to Ghana 30 years ago is the same reason Selassie is staying now. 400 years after the first captive Africans were taken from their continent and enslaved in Virginia, the U.S. still isn't a place Mona's family wants to be.
Thanks to Rupa Shenoy from the PRX radio show The World for bringing us that story. To listen to more of Rupa's reporting from Ghana, go to theworld.org. While Mona Boyd's family is staying put in Ghana, African Americans here are looking at the origins of American slavery with a fresh eye and discovering some surprises. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.